continue our series on a vision for a new year. I'm using the vision statement for Temple Baptist Church, which is faith, worship, and obedience. And today's message brings us to the second of those, worship. Very simply put, worship. What is worship? I think most people have preconceived notions of what worship was represented by, that it involves singing, and that what we just did was the worship portion of the service. We're all a little guilty of saying that. We struggle a bit with that as well. But the reality is that biblical worship has little to do with a set parameter of a time for a service or with music in particular. Worship is an expression of life. From a biblical point of view, worship is something that is going to be a reflection so that we are continually, by our words, our actions, our attitudes, our transformation, all the things that we experience in this life, that by all of those things, that what is being seen in worship is that our lives are lived in order to elevate God, in order to give worth to Him. And so worship is an experience of life that is supposed to be also an expression of life. When we limit it to one area of a given time, regardless of what that is, then we are devaluing the biblical intent of worship. So this is why it's part of the vision of the church, is that we are striving to grow in our connection to Christ in a way that is going to ultimately make us all a reflection of Him in every area of life. Now, worship simply means that we also, not just by the way we live or the things we do, we reflect what we value most. Whether it's our self-interest, whether it's the interest of the world around us, or whether it's God. Worship is a way in which we define what matters most for us, not by just what we say, but also by how we live. So what does the Bible have to say specifically? There is perhaps no other passage more specific to this subject than Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. There, Paul says, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." Three things that come out of this passage that I would direct our attention to today. First, in the first part of verse 1, you see the foundation for worship. I appeal to you, therefore. The foundation for worship is built by motivating us. So the motivation for believers. He says that I urge you, I appeal to you, I encourage you. He doesn't say, notice, I command you. Rather than command, Paul urges the reader on the basis of love and gratitude. Obedience to a command is going to produce an emotional response along with it that carries a sense of obligation. Obligation then means that we probably are doing it because we feel that we owe something, or we fear that something may be done to us if we fail. That sort of obligation, that sort of obedience, while I think is probably inescapable for us at times, is not really the motivation for worship. The motivation for worship must always be love. And so because of that, Paul is urging us, he is appealing to us on the basis of love. All that has been written in the book of Romans prior to this verse speaks to the very nature and work of God. If you go back and you read Romans chapters 1 through 11, it is a theological treatment that reveals for us the nature of God. It tells us who God is. Yes, there are also included in that instructions for the believer as to how we respond. But Paul was writing to a new church in Rome that was made up of a pretty broad group of backgrounds and people groups in order to bring them together, not on the basis of what they observed or how they lived, but on the basis of who they knew. He was introducing them to God. This is who God is. And here are the details about his nature that can be revealed. This is what doctrine and theology is all about. It's about helping us to understand more fully the nature of who God is. And as we understand who God is, then it elicits from us a response that will be likewise filled with love and grace. So the motivation for the believers when he says, I appeal to you, brothers, was based on the understanding of who God is. So the more we know about him, the more we know how to be motivated to love and service. But he says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God. So not only is there a motivation for believers in the foundation for worship, but there are also the mercies of God. The true foundation, in fact, for genuine worship is the mercy of God. Now, the word is plural, mercies, more than one. And when we think about it that way, it becomes a little more complicated. Because now you have a tendency to go back and let's create a list of all the mercies of God. That's not really what's intended here, but it is implied. The reason it is implied is because regardless of what you experience in a moment where you recognize God's mercy, it is but a small fraction of the reality of his grace. And so the psalmist will tell us that God's mercy is new every morning, meaning that the awareness of that which has been true all along is made known in a new way every day. And so the mercies of God is intended in a plural fashion so that it encompasses all that we experience by his grace, his love, his long-suffering, his patience. Everything that is true of us, we know is worthy of judgment and condemnation. Sin is something that stands in direct opposition to who God is and to what God has called us to be as well. And yet it is the mercy of God that holds back that which we actually deserve. It is the mercy of God that enables us that opportunity for redemption and restoration by his grace. And so he says we are motivated and urged by the relationship that we have with Paul when he calls us brothers, but we are also motivated by the mercies of God in light of all that he has done. False worship is something that is always in the mind of biblical writers because it was so prevalent in their day. It is prevalent in our day as well to the same extent, if not even greater. It just takes on a different form. Whereas false worship offers sacrifice in order to obtain mercy, true and genuine biblical faith teaches us that the divine mercy has already been experienced, thus providing us the motivation for sacrifice and love as a fitting response to God. So we don't offer ourselves as living sacrifices in order to receive mercy, but rather because mercy has already been experienced. It is a fine point, I realize, and even some might look at it and say it's something of a thread that is fairly fine and narrow. And is it really important to make that distinction? I would say to that not only is it important, it is absolutely essential because it alters the entire tenor and the entire tone of your life. If you are living your life before God in the hope of achieving something from him or earning something or avoiding something, then your motivation will always be dependent on your performance. And therefore, you will live your life with uncertainty and fear. You will be up and down almost in a spiritual roller coaster ride of emotions along the way. At the times that you feel good in your relationship with God, you will probably take credit for that yourself which is undeserved. And in the times that you feel desperate and destitute before God, you will probably overstate that in some sort of an unresolved guilt that can easily be exploited by Satan. Both of them are destructive, and what it does is it sets the believer on a path of a spiritual circle in which we cycle from one of these things to the other, but never breaking free to make true progress in our walk with God. It is a difficult thing, and I understand it. I can talk about it. I can tell you about it. I also am subject to it. And yet, the more we understand the distinctives of who God is and what He has done, and the more we understand the nature of true worship, the more we can be motivated by the mercy of God already revealed in its fullest form through Jesus Christ. Foundation for worship, then, is a motivation for believers, and it is the mercy of God. Secondly, there is a dedication to worship. Look in the latter part of verse 1. He says, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Dedication to worship is always going to be personal. It has to be. It has to be personal. No spiritual service or progress ever occurs without a decisive act of the will. Moving forward in the Christian life is never automatic, but must be deliberate. It must be intentional. So while sanctification is something that happens to the believer over the entire course of life, each progressive step that we make as we move forward in our spiritual growth, it lends greater understanding, maybe opens a doorway of new ministry, provides the ability to help or to provide support to someone else, maybe gets us through a crisis period of time. All of those things happen not automatically, but deliberately. So because of that, in chapter 12, verse 1, he says, I appeal to you to present yourselves. There is an act of the will that is absolutely essential, and the only way for us to do that is to present ourselves. We must be intentional. That being said, what is it we present? He said, present your bodies. So are we talking about a physical sacrifice that is being called upon? We are, but that is not the only thing. So the word body that is used here certainly can describe the physical form, and does. However, in the ancient mind, it would have also included everything that that body is a representative of. And so the physical presence is a representation by which we relate to each other and the world around us. But we assume the presence of the personality, we assume the act of the will, we assume the intellect of the individual. All of the things that make up who we are incorporated into what he tells us to present. Present yourselves would be another way to say it, in their entirety, and engage every part of who you are. So following Jesus and being an active servant of His as an extension or expression of our worship is going to mean that physically we are going to do that. That means we're going to go places and we're going to do things and we're going to be involved in stuff. We're going to do not just what satisfies or makes us feel good, but we're going to do what is compelled by the calling of God through the work of the Holy Spirit in us. And so all of these things are going to be an extension, and it's going to involve a physical reality. That means a commitment of time. It means a stewardship of resources. It means everything that we are to be about and everything that we are is going to be affected. There are some places that you will go and some you will choose not to. There are some things you will do and some things you will choose not to. All of this will be a part of the reality of serving Christ and following this motivation to present yourselves as a living sacrifice. People tell me all the time about their church affiliation. And occasionally the conversation will give me an opportunity to say, "So what do you do there?" I had this conversation last week, interestingly enough, with someone who was telling me about the church that they attended. And they didn't say they were a member of the church. They didn't say they were involved in the church. They just said that they attended the church. And that's fine. And that's not an inappropriate way to describe where you go to church. I said, so what are you involved in there? What do you like most about that church? Well, I just go to church on Sunday. And I said, do you go every Sunday? And the person said, well, I didn't know this was going to turn into an inquisition. I said, well, now that you know, are you willing to continue? And he said, well, he said, maybe a couple more questions. No, I don't go every Sunday, but I try to. And I said, so have you met the pastor? No, it's a big church. There's a lot of people there. I said, so? I said, he's still just one person. I didn't ask if you met everybody in the church. I asked if you met the pastor. I mean, you're going to sit under someone who's going to preach to you every week, who's going to lead the church that you attend, and you're not even going to shake the hand of that person and try to pick up some kind of vibe or, you know, see whether there's any connection or sense of genuineness. I mean, that's why we have the Holy Spirit in us, in order to create discernment. And discernment's what allows us to connect with other people and to know a little bit about, you know, that response and that relationship. And so we had this in-depth question. I said, I don't mean to put you on the spot, which is not really true. I actually did mean to do that. I said, it sounds to me like this is something that is a good starting place for you, but needs to go a lot further. Now, to give you some background, the conversation that precipitated this was based on some statements about, you know, I'm struggling in this area, or I'm dealing with this issue, or I'm confronted. And I said to them, as I got into this conversation, I said, if you were to engage this church family in a way that is initiated by you, now what you're going to do is you're going to create a group of people that will provide you with accountability, with support, encouragement. You're going to also get involved in more than just attendance. You're going to become an active contributor to what God is doing in that church family. And now you're going to have the sense of fulfillment, because this is what you're made for in the first place. And it's going to resolve about 50% of the things you've already told me are a problem without you even doing anything other than taking another step forward. Now, is church the answer to every problem? No, sometimes it's the problem itself. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am saying is that it is an extension and expression of who we are supposed to be. Remember when he said, present your bodies, he reminds us that we are the body of Christ. There's a connection there that's undeniable. And so worship is something that requires an intentional act of the will, but it also is a dedication that is uniquely personal, that is going to involve the entire being. It's more than just being present in something here, there, or wherever, but it includes the mind, it includes the will, it includes the physical presence, so that what we are offering to God is all that we are, everything that we are. The presentation of the body, then, is at once an act that is spiritual, intellectual, and physical. He says, offer yourselves as a living sacrifice. This is in contrast, of course, to the dead animal sacrifices of the Old Covenant. When they would take the animal and they would sacrifice its life and they would place it on the altar, the entire animal would then be burned up and consumed as a sweet savor unto God. It was not offered in order to cause God to be favorable. It was offered as worship and thanksgiving for the favor God had already shown. Here's the flaw in the in the way in which people took hold of God's law. So when we look at the Old Testament, we look at the sacrificial system and we hear the commands that come from him and come out of that passage, we assume that this is about us obeying the laws and the statutes and keeping the covenant. And that's what it says. But are we doing that to earn what God has given? Or do we recognize that the very fact that God is giving us the means by which we can rightly relate to him on a personal, ongoing basis shows that he's already given mercy. He's already called us to himself. He's already made us a people unique to his purpose. So that now the sacrifice that we offer is not to get something in return. It is as an expression of gratitude and dedication to what has already been given. The sacrifices are to be living. It means active or dynamic. And so that when we offer ourselves to God, it means being subject to change. God, I'll do this, but here are the parameters I'm willing to follow. As long as it doesn't cost too much, as long as it doesn't take too long. I don't want to be in any awkward situations with other people. I don't want to feel uncomfortable ever. I don't want to go someplace that may be threatening to me or might present some sort of risk. I don't want to do any of that. But if you can find something for me to do that is safe and is comfortable, is convenient and doesn't cost anything, then I'll do that. That's not really presenting yourself as a living sacrifice. Now, I think a lot of times when we present ourselves to the Lord and we say, Lord, I'm responding to your call, I've never had that happen in my life where I had a clear vision of the entire picture that was about to unfold. I started out doing everything that God has called me to do, and I still do this with the idea that this is what he has shown me at the moment, and so I'm going to have to take that step of faith there, knowing that once you take that step, now everything that is beyond that is going to probably be a little different than I imagined it. The question is, are you a living sacrifice? Is it dynamic and able to adjust and to take on more as we progress through that experience and through that life? I believe it is, and this is what he is calling us to do, so that when we present ourselves in a personal way as a living sacrifice, we are doing so acknowledging and recognizing that, yeah, it may look a little different than we thought it was going to, but that's okay. So, Lord, you set the timetable. You direct the path. You determine the cost, and we will trust and believe in your sufficiency in the midst of it. He says, present yourselves then as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. So not only is it personal, but the dedication to worship must also be pleasing. Holy and acceptable means pleasing to God. Now, holy means to be set apart for God, so that anything that is declared holy means that it is set apart from every other use or purpose and used only for the purpose by which it's been designated, usually in the worship of God. So to give an example, in the Old Testament, there were certain vessels that would have been in the tabernacle, later in the temple, that were declared holy and were used only for their designated purpose in that worship, even though they could have been used for other things, and they even were in the same form that were perhaps common everyday vessels, these were unique, thereby declared holy. Likewise, you are unique. God's children are unique and set apart for his purpose. It usually fails to convey this meaning, however, to the average English reading mind. You see, the idea of holy is usually one of moral purity, so that when we hear that we are to present ourselves as living sacrifices that are holy and acceptable to God, we determine that that means I've got to be morally pure, or I have to at least convince everybody else I am. Moral purity is, of course, involved in our dedication to God. I wouldn't take that away by any means, but it isn't something that we achieve, but rather it is what comes from being holy. You don't make yourself holy by being morally pure. God makes you holy and sets you apart, and morality grows out of that. Again, we see how so often false worship attempts to twist or manipulate or corrupt the way in which God has called us to worship Him. So that when we offer ourselves as living sacrifices, we are made perfect, we are made righteous, not by our own doing or our own activity, but by His grace and by His declaration. So that when we receive Jesus Christ, we receive also the righteousness of Christ in our lives. It is not our own, but His that redeems us. So we are now set apart, belonging to Him, and we are made holy in order to live consistently with what He has called us to, His nature. Holy and pleasing. So when we offer ourselves as living sacrifices, this is set apart for the worship of God, but it is also pleasing to God. He says this is your spiritual worship. The word spiritual is translated differently, so depending on what translation you're reading from, you'll find it in a variety of forms. Some use the word reasonable. This is your reasonable worship. That is a good word, and it goes along with the meaning, but it loses a little bit in my mind. When I hear that word, reasonable, then it makes it sound like, based on everything that we've heard up to this point, it only makes sense that you would offer yourself as a living sacrifice, and that that would be your worship. I don't know, that doesn't quite fit with the way I feel about this passage or understand what he's teaching. I think spiritual worship is probably a better use of terms in order to describe. The only other one that I find is proper, but that's not a common word for us. We don't use that word very often anymore. I think it's well known and understood, but it means suitable. It means consistent. It is proper for us to do this, not in a way that gives dignity or honor, although those things are certainly part of that. That isn't the point. The point is that it is a consistency that creates a degree of connection and comfort in our relationship with God. You see, I think a lot of people live with strained relationships all around us. Maybe it's in family, maybe marriage, maybe relationships at work with coworkers that you don't necessarily see eye to eye with, or fellow students in school. And so we live with these strained relationships. There's an awkwardness, and there's a lack of comfort as a result of that. There's a lack of honesty. There's some risk involved and vulnerability that can never really be expressed because we're too busy protecting ourselves. And so the relationships that we have in this life many times are like that, to the point where there's not a consistency that flows in that that creates a level of comfort and familiarity, so that that relationship becomes absolutely natural. That's what he's describing here. This is your spiritual worship, is a way of saying that when we follow this pattern that he has set before us and we initiate a response to who God is as the merciful, loving God that he has shown himself to be, and we become involved in that in a way that is all-inclusive, body, mind, and spirit. And then we allow him to lead us as living sacrifices devoted to him in this way, then this becomes the spiritual worship. And what we experience is a flow in our relationship with God, unbroken by all of these other things. This is what he's calling us to. This is what genuine worship is. It is living and walking with God, following the leadership of Jesus Christ, listening to the Word of God, understanding through the Spirit of God, all of these things coming together so that we then are sharing that in the world around us. This is worship. In verse 2, we see thirdly transformation that comes through worship. So a foundation for worship is built on His mercy. A dedication to worship is the call to offer ourselves as living sacrifices. And the transformation through worship comes in verse 2 when He says, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good, acceptable, and perfect." Transformation through worship. One author who spoke on this says that it begins with devotion. I like that. Dedication and devotion are very similar, but it's that decisive commitment. So he says, do not be conformed to this world. There is a decision to be made with regard to transformation. I said to you earlier that every forward progressive movement that we make in our spiritual growth begins with an act of the will. Conformity to a world that largely rejects God and is destined for destruction is to be caught up in that same rebellion. He says, do not be conformed to the world. Rather than being conformed to the world of sin and death, we are to be transformed by a life of hope and promise. So he says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed through the renewal of your mind. There is a focus here that I don't have time to explore, but I want to someday. Don't know when that day will be. But I come back to this on a regular basis. When he says, be transformed through the renewal of the mind, that phrase, renewal of the mind, is really, really important. It may be one of the most important phrases that you see in any of the text I've read to you today, because it may be, in fact, the key of what happens in us as we follow Him. People say, well, you know, loving Jesus is all about how you feel. No, feelings are a part of it, but it is not all about that. There's a great deal of emphasis placed on emotions within spiritual matters, and sometimes to the detriment. The Bible never talks about how you feel first. It always talks about what you think first. The mind is the key. Until the mind is transformed, until the mind is being led of the Spirit, until the mind is able to grasp the principles of truth and apply them in a way that is going to be consistent in the life of the believer, then everything else is going to falter. And that includes how you feel. Emotions are always going to be informed by intellect. If you want to change what a person's feeling inside, you have to begin with helping them to understand what they're thinking about it, what they believe. So I say that to say that I have in my mind somewhere a whole series of sermons on intellect and its influence on spiritual development. But I've not gone that far yet. But this is one of the key passages that I see as an important element in that. So devotion comes as a result of a dedication or a decisive commitment to being transformed in the mind rather than conformed to the world. He says, so that by the testing you may discern what is the will of God. Devotion is absolutely essential. Discernment is what results. The transformed mind is now enabled to think like Christ, to see the world through the eyes of Christ. Having the mind of Christ is more than just discerning what is right and wrong, but it's also choosing what is best. Just as Jesus came to do the will of God, so the believer can now follow in the path of knowing and doing the will of God because of what He is doing in us. Discernment. By testing, you may discern what is the will of God. We get caught up a lot of times trying to know the will of God, usually in relation to very specific or particular points of reference, but in reality, the will of God is best understood in a much larger scale. And God's will is that redemption would result in as many as possible coming back into that relationship with Him, that He would ultimately be glorified above all else. And then He concludes that transformation through worship comes as a result so that we have what is good, acceptable, and perfect. If devotion describes the intention of the will and mind, if discernment is the result that allows us to know and do the will of God, then when He describes good, acceptable, and perfect, He's describing delight in the believer over what we have experienced in Him. Growing in the transformed life leads to delight in that which glorifies God. It isn't just satisfaction. It is also the sense of fulfillment of purpose. God is not merely rewarding good behavior, but He is validating the life to which He has called each of us. Warren Wiersbe wraps this up, and you may or may not know who that is, but he has written extensively many years ago and has been a friend to pastors through all the years for his works. They are simple, they are direct, they're usually in an outline form, and they just fit with every person that reads them. There's a quote that I found in one of the expository outlines of the New Testament that he gave. It says this: "True dedication is the presenting of body, mind, and will to God day by day. It is daily yielding the body to Him, having the mind renewed by His word, and surrendering the will through prayer and obedience." It is a very adequate description of what genuine worship is all about. You'll notice there's no mention of music, of church services, of events. It's all about your relationship with God. The vision for our future will always be dependent on our willingness to be the people He has called us to be, and He has called us to be true worshipers, to worship Him in spirit and in truth.